Hello, everyone. I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode. While you're there, rate and review us as well. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Reason Magazine Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward. Catherine, good to hear you.
Howdy.
And Reason Editor-at-Large Matt Welch. Hello, Matt.
What's up?
All right. So today, we're going to talk about Meryl Streep and other creative types kind of going on strike because of Donald Trump, and we're also going to talk about the fast approaching reality that is Donald Trump's presidency. He gets sworn in on January 20th. We're going to argue over whether this Republican Congress will be better than the one that served under President Bush, which was terrible. And finally, we'll also discuss Obama's legacy as president on Tuesday, January 10th. He's going to give a big speech. Big farewell speech in Chicago, a city he will almost certainly never set foot in again after January 10th. So let's get right to it. Meryl Streep, Matt, gave a talk. She received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes, which is put together by the Foreign Press Association, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. What do you think? She asked her fellow creative types, and she said, you know, people in TV, we're not talking about sports and we're not talking about cable news, but, you know, that we've got to stand up and protect the powerless in America. Is this more Hollywood cluelessness, or is it a powerful rebuke to Trumptards? You know, and there are other artists the New York Times was writing about, including people like the art photographer Cindy Sherman and the sculptor Richard Serra, who are planning a creative strike on the inauguration day. Is this good, bad? What's your reaction to it?
Richard Serra is having a creative strike. Does this mean he's not going to dump a 20-ton ugly piece of sculpture on the Washington
Mall? Yeah, I was going to say,
possibly going to survive.
His creative strike may be running longer than the table grape boycott that was launched sometime in the late 60s, but judged by
don't
his work.
Don't drink Coors. Whatever you do, don't drink Coors. I watched all the Golden Globes last night, and obviously the high point was Steve Carell and Kristen Wiig. I think the only high point of it. The Meryl Streep speech, so my kind of 95,000 foot view of this, so I'm orbiting and gasping in low Earth orbit on this, is that so in the last like week or so, there have been half a dozen essays. I tried to write one of them over at Reason. Greg Ip at the Wall Street Journal, Timothy Garton Ash, the New York Review of Books, Martin Wolf at the Financial Times.
Matt, are you signaling Al Qaeda masters? What is, do you have a long list of people you owe shout outs to or something?
Yes. Okay. No. I mean, there is a feeling among many people that I share that we are exiting one era and entering in something that's new and not terrifying, new and, right. and troubling and just different. The old era, the post-Cold War era of kind of increasing multilateralism, free trade, prosperity, liberal democracies, yada, yada, is now being replaced by a populist nationalism whose politics will be marked by cultural conflicts between the countryside and the city folk. Mm-hmm. If you take that as a possibility, as a granted, as a given, or anything, and you think strategically, how might I approach that? I don't think what you'd do is start running down Monday Night Football and mixed martial arts by saying, you know, they're not doing the real art. We are. The strategic tone deafness of this stuff is what gets at me. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter. I don't really care. I'm kind of glad to see the art being against politics after an 8-year or a respite, although we should point out that Meryl Streep spoke at the Democratic
Convention. Yeah, no, and it's not about – it isn't about artists being against politics, right? It's that they have a different set of politics that they feel is being squeezed out just like Hillary Clinton was.
Art against the people who were about to hold power, or at least some of them. But there is something more than a bit ridiculous. Jacob Solem wrote the best possible take on this, I think, today, which is – that there's many reasons to be alarmed by Donald Trump, and some of them Meryl Streep hinted at, including his just kind of ignorant kind of bullying and then dissembling about it. And yet, let's not pretend that Hollywood is this class that is threatened to be deported sometime soon, and that kind of stuff. And let's recognize that this is the people that you're trying to persuade were opposite of persuaded by that. Every time that Meryl Streep goes up there and talks about that, the people in Robbie Suave's home county who voted for Obama twice and Donald Trump this time around are not going to be persuaded when you run down their cultural choices in the act of saying that Donald Trump is a boor.
But the point wasn't for her to persuade them, right? I mean, that wasn't what she was doing. She was signaling her own virtue on the biggest possible platform, and that includes signaling that she is above the crappy culture that dominates the rest of America in the form of mixed martial arts. I mean, I didn't watch a single minute of the Golden Globes because I can't stand it when people embarrass themselves on television. So I just had to like watch it in controlled doses later when I can like turn it off and scream in between. But I did, of course, watch the Meryl Streep speech this morning, and she couldn't have chosen a more perfect thing to call out there than football and mixed martial arts. That's exactly what she was doing. She was saying, I am not one of these people who voted for Trump, and I look down on them. She was not trying to convince them. She was trying to separate herself from them.
That's, I think that you're onto something. The other thing that is, or one of the things that I found interesting, and Matt, this goes to the tone deafness part, is that, you know, Monday Night Football has never been less popular in its 30 or 40 year history, and football overall is actually tanking. And yet it also remains something that, you know, a lot of celebrities are really into. And Los Angeles just spent a ton of, you know, they spent decades trying to get a football team back there. What about the higher? I mean, is this a replay if the Saul Bellow novel Humboldt's Gift has this great moment where in the late 50s, when Adlai Stevenson was running, and he ran and lost twice in 52 and 56, but he was a cultured guy. And there's a whole riff in the novel about how artists were ready finally to have an America that was kind of cultivated and sophisticated. And nobody figured that more or personified that more than Adlai Stevenson, who was this classy guy and an ambassador and a senator and cultured, versus Eisenhower, who, even though he had been the president of Columbia University, was kind of a dummy and never read a book. And then people were crushed when Stevenson got his doors blown off. You go back to when Andrew Jackson rolled into town when he became president and vanquished John Quincy Adams, who was a Harvard grad and all this. And he had a big, massive party with a giant wheel of cheese, and all the hoi polloi showed up. I mean, is this just a replay of consistent, elitists being against the lumpen proletariat when they do the wrong thing?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. It's just that I think now that sort has gotten larger or more monochromatic. You know, I'm sitting in a neighborhood in Brooklyn that voted 92% for Hillary Clinton. I'm guessing that this same neighborhood, if you went back 20 years ago, it was more like a 60-40 type of neighborhood. And probably the same is true in reverse kind of bubble areas like Idaho, North Dakota, and so on. And so I think Hollywood is probably becoming more monochromatic in its kind of cultural politics. Michael Wolff had a pretty good piece about this today, saying that, you know, he's looking at the character of Steve Bannon, Breitbart News guy, incoming Donald Trump senior advisor. And he was saying, you know, imagining who could, in our current journalism world, portray this guy who's always sort of striving on the outside. He's cycled through three marriages. He wants to be in politics, but he's on the outside of it. He's got this kind of complicated views. He's a classic figure that a Gore Vidal even, or a Norman Mailer, or, you know, Tom Wolfe back in the day would be able to portray. He's a character that exists in American life. But right now, the kind of people who are in charge of portrayals, who do the journalism, to do the movies, they just look at him in horror and try to find different ways to express their horror, whether it's as a virtue signal, which I think is a kind of a good phrase. I mean, sometimes it's just an honest reaction. I mean, let's say that Meryl Streep's reaction was 1,000% honest. Part of the point is that there isn't people around her or around the sort of cultural production centers that are in a position to even kind of begin to interpret these people on their own terms, and I think that's problematic.
But isn't that the same as, excuse me?
Go on.
Is that different than, you know, the way Bob Roberts was portrayed by Tim Robbins, who was a folk singing conservative that was modeled on Dana Rohrabacher, and that had to be 20 or 25 years ago. I mean, I don't think, you know, when you go back and you look at Hollywood, they've never had a nuanced view or a sophisticated view or an engagement with, you know, the other, the political other. They're almost always being revealed ultimately as scumbags and secret perverts. And, you know, I remembered watching Beverly Hills 90210 back in the day. And anytime anybody came from the Midwest other than the Brendan and Brenda or Brent. Yeah. What were their names? Brenda and Brendan, something like that. But anytime they came from Minnesota originally, but anytime anybody else from the Midwest came, they were immediately or by the end of the episode unmasked as perverts and child molesters and whatnot. So
just to interject before Catherine
Brandon
comes in, an important part about Bob Roberts is that it was entertaining and funny.
Yeah.
There's been a couple of like mock videos of the Ernest celebrity, you know, videos that have come out. One by our friends over at Red Eye, and another one by our other friends over at Town Hall. And the Town Hall one ended, it was like Mary Catherine Hand and Guy Benson, where they ended, and I think with a pretty good note, which is like, hey, celebrities, please, next time, try harder. You're good at entertainment. Do the entertainment part. Then that might make your politics sell better. And I think there's something to that.
Okay. So, yeah, Catherine, do you what do you think is more important, to be edifying or to be entertaining? And I guess that runs up against the idea that that Hollywood is virtue signaling here. They don't actually want to convince anybody of their point of view. They just want to wrap themselves a little tighter in their Versace gowns and throws and whatever men wear when they have a lot of money to buy nice clothes.
Versace gowns and throws still, I think, for the men folk. No, I mean, I think the idea that they are virtue signaling is just a subset of branding, right? And that's what they're actually good at. They're doing what they're actually good at. Now, are they doing it effectively in this case? I would say not particularly, but I also think people will mostly ignore this and still go to movies, which is why they can afford to do it.
Right. If the movies are good, right? Because, I mean,
actually make the movies worse, right? Like this kind of garbage political editorializing does not undermine the quality of movies, largely because aside from the very narrow performances by the actual actors, movies aren't. They're not, the quality is not determined by the actors. There's so many other people who are rarely given the platform to signal in this way.
Before we leave this topic, though, and Matt, I'm thinking because you're closer in age to me than young Catherine, aren't all of the great moments from the Oscars political statements, whether it was Marlon Brando refusing his Oscar for The Godfather and sending up Sasheen Littlefeather, or Vanessa Redgrave shouting out to the Palestinians to kill more Jews, and even the streaker that befouled the stage in the mid-70s. I mean, like I struggle to remember Oscar moments that weren't about that.
That's why you shouldn't watch this stuff. It's so horrible.
Yeah. No, I'm sure there have been other good moments. Actually, the biggest disappointment for me last night, besides the fact that I had no idea what they were talking about, any single bit of entertainment besides The Americans, which sadly didn't win, is that they bogarted the celebrity deaths segment. They just like did a like, oh, you know, Carrie Fisher, Debbie Reynolds died, and that's sad. And they left all the other great celebrities who died last year just hanging. That's always my favorite part, is the celebrity deaths segment.
More of an Oscars thing than a Golden Globes thing, though?
No, they do it in all of them now.
Yeah. I mean, of all the years, 2016 should be like, we should just give the whole show over to celebrity deaths, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Will 2017 be better? I think it's going to be tough, you know, unless there's some kind of bus crash. I don't know.
I am appalled that I haven't heard yet about any New Year's Eve band playing their entire night a deadly medley. I just think that it's so obvious. You could play 3 hours on tunes from people who died in 2016.
Rock and roll heaven is, it's tough to get even a 5 minute setup there nowadays.
Right? You know what, Nick? I think to answer your question honestly, though, about those political moments, that just says there's something wrong with you. And that you're too wired politically here, and that you should
appreciate the moments of like sheer human joy.
I liked when Roberto Benigni, who won for a very political movie, Life is Beautiful, which was great, and that's got to be almost 10 years, but 10 years old when he won and he walked on top of people down to the stage. That was great. I write a couple times a week about how life beyond politics is so much more important and meaningful. That's why we want to squeeze it down to the smallest part of our lives. But I love political art. And I think I wouldn't say all good art is political, but the politics of art are really important. And I love, our former colleague, Chuck Freund, who would write about how songs about puppy love in the Soviet Union were considered the most outrageous and extreme political statement precisely because they were not about politics. But art always has a politics.
I just wish more
artists had smart politics rather than this dumb shit, mentality of like, Trump is so crude and vulgar and he puts gold on everything. Not like classy Hollywood people who have sophisticated views about everything. That kind of sticks in my craw.
To overly take all of this a little bit too seriously, but I think there's some points in there nonetheless. Václav Havel, who we wrote about in our book, his political response came as a defense of a rock band. And part of that defense was his veneration of their living within the truth, as the way he put it. Right. And as one of the members of the band, a sort of a poet, eminence behind it, had always talked about living in truth or living within the truth, by which they meant living your authentic self regardless of outside influence. And I thought about that phrase a couple of nights ago when the great Nat Hentoff died, great civil libertarian jazz writer and stuff. And I went back and I had not read Jack Schaefer, our friend, if he can really be friends with anybody, had tweeted out, and Jesse Walker also did in his blog post, I think linked to Hentoff's incredible piece for The New Yorker on Bob Dylan circa like 1964, I think it was, where he was more or less in the studio when Dylan was recording. I think Blonde on Blonde, that has It Ain't Me, Babe, and that kind of stuff on it, Nick, is the Dylanophile. And it's a great piece. And in there, Dylan is, as quoted there, is obsessed with people trying to put him in boxes and the importance of like getting all the boxes out so that you could try to live free. And it's very similar to that living within the truth thing. And that's not only important from an artistic sense, but as in any place where there is creeping authoritarianism or actual authoritarianism, actually living according to your authentic self, everyone else be damned, especially the government, is in itself an incredibly potent act of not just resistance, hashtag resist, all this kind of stuff. It's a threat to that order, and it is the source of the energy that will end up kind of cleaning that out or challenging that. So for all those people who feel like hashtag resisting right now, one way to do it is not necessarily to put a safety pin on your website, or just to say that you're resisting. But if you actually live according to your authentic self, you will strengthen the institutions out there that will always, always thwart the attempts of any authoritarian to take over this wonderful country of ours.
This sounds a lot like George W. Bush telling us to go out and buy socks and underwear after 9/11 to show that we're not playing by the terrorist rules.
I
wanted to ask you specifically, though, because you in the current issue of Reason, you have a great interview with the novelist Lionel Shriver, who is American-born and raised, but lives most of the time or a good chunk of her time in England. Talk a little bit about that, because she is somebody who is an artist of the highest order. She is a literary novelist, very well regarded, has also come out over the past 18 months or so as a pretty thoroughgoing libertarian. How does that play into what Matt is talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm inspired as fuck by Matt's speech about living our authentic selves. Yeah. But I think that Meryl Streep saying Donald Trump sucks and so do mixed martial arts isn't quite on the same order. And one reason that's true, and
as protesting a Soviet puppet government that was putting shitty rock bands in prison. I mean, if let's just put it this way, if you put every shitty rock band in prison, you think we're a jailer nation now.
Yeah,
we would be outsourcing to South America.
I'm kind of into it, yeah. But I do think that the sort of Lionel Shriver zone is the gray area between, okay, do we actually live in an authoritarian state where artists are being imprisoned? No. And will we by the end of Trump's administration? Almost certainly no. However, what she said in my interview with her, which, you know, frankly, turned me from fan of her writing into like insane fangirl of her personally. And I would really urge people to check out that interview and anything else that she has to say. You know, she said, I thought I was saying something that was so uncontroversial to the point of potentially being boring when I got up on a stage and said novelists should be allowed to write characters that do not directly draw on their own experience. A white lady should be allowed to write a Hispanic character, essentially. And that the reaction to it was a clue to her that she has apparently become a radical against her own plan. She said, you know, that really wasn't her idea. And I do think that's a sign that something is wrong. When somebody says something they think should be boring and uncontroversial that was boring and uncontroversial 10 years ago and everyone loses their shit.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of fascinating, Matt, to go back to the case of Havel and the Plastic People of the Universe. One of the things that is and actually even the Velvet Underground, because the Velvet Underground, who were Havel's one of his very favorite bands in the Czechoslovakian revolt against the Soviet, was called the Velvet Revolution, an homage to them. You know, they were a non-political band. They sang about, you know, getting high or getting, getting a fix of heroin and things like that at a time when everybody else was talking about, Abraham, Martin, and John. So it's interesting. But what I'm getting at is there's this larger mismatch where artists in America seem to always want to be in a kind of totalitarian or authoritarian place that doesn't exist in America. And it's not to say that people aren't jerk-offs and people don't hate each other and talk mean about each other. But, you know, Wesley Snipes went to prison because he didn't pay his taxes. He didn't go to prison because Passenger 57 or the Blade movies were some kind of affront to, you know, the national security state. But artists are always acting as if the lockdown, the clampdown is about to happen. And it seems like they're trying to vicariously participate in a ruthless totalitarianism that ironically many of them supported or their predecessors supported.
That, I think, points to what rankled kind of the most about Meryl Streep's speech last night is the sense of that the center of victimhood was somewhere near the Beverly Hilton last night. And that's just it's really hard not to break out cackling and when something like that happens. Yeah, there is this kind of envy of victimization. I mean, I saw this. I went to college in the late 1980s. And back then, there was among the student activists then who were protesting South African apartheid and this kind of stuff. And Ronald Reagan, there was activist envy. There was 60s envy because they went back and like, man, you guys got hosed. You know, they shot some of you in Kent State. That seems cool. And that's always sort of there and weird and off-putting, this desire to be trotted upon more heavily.
And her kind of weirdly borrowing the victimhood of like what I can only assume she's referring to is like the Indian digital FX guy who's here on an H-1B that might get taken away by Trump, right? Like when she says there are immigrants and outsiders in Hollywood, like what does she mean if not like we're borrowing the status of people that we were cheerfully ignoring from this stage and everywhere else until 5 hot minutes ago?
Yeah, and also, as Jacob points out in his blog post, she's doing this in critiquing a president-elect who's married a couple of these types of people. You know, I mean, Melania Trump is a Slovenian model. His first wife was a Czech skier. And, you know, he's actually aware of the category of people and the category of visas that they're on. So, yeah, that's all a bit odd. But what the authentic self argument is it, I mean, I once remember interviewing the bass player of the Plastic People, the late Melon Hlawsa, and they didn't understand English when they were hearing the Velvet Underground. And he put in this great quote to me, like, when you heard John Cale's violin, you knew it was against something. And there's something to that. There's a minority of artists out there whose work is explicitly political and it is still good. You know, The Clash were good. I know Nick disagrees with me on that. I would say Billy Bragg, who's a total commie, can make good art. Rage Against the Machine, total commies or total Marxists, but they can make good art. But that's a minority. The majority of artists who dabble in politics end up making crude things, and what's more, I mean, like bad art, and what is more political is the art that isn't necessarily political. It's art that's that is more authentic. And the irony of last night, among others, is that we're talking about this in an era where televised series is great about finding empathy in all kinds of places. Donald Glover was up there in the worst suit I have seen this side of me wearing suits, accepting victories for Atlanta. And by all accounts, Atlanta is just this incredible gender bending race kind of expectations bending show that is really great about locating empathy with all kinds of different kinds of characters and just surprising all of your expectations. So Hollywood is actually really good at this, especially right now on television. But as it zeroes in on presidential politics, that's where it gets stupid and not smart.
Well, let's talk about presidential politics just to move forward to the reality of the Trump presidency. None of us on this podcast voted for Trump. One of us did not even vote, which is its own act of political authenticity, I suppose, authentic self. But what are the grounds, as we're a couple weeks away from Trump becoming president, Catherine? What is the, you know, are you scared? Are you happy? Is it a mix? What is the thing that is bothering you the most about the rise or, you know, the start of the Trump administration?
I would say I've pretty much already reverted to my baseline, which is the assumption that we're going to muddle through. And I think, you know, that some of this Oscar stuff has highlighted that for me, that I've already kind of flipped back to everybody simmer down. He's not oppressing you, or at least not yet. Maybe that means I'll later be complicit. Like, they came for Meryl Streep and I wasn't Meryl Streep, so I said nothing. But I do think that the immigration stuff is the most worrying, and the sort of pairing of the immigration stuff and the anti-Islam stuff, which was a centerpiece of his campaign. That said, looking back at Obama's legacy, nothing that was a centerpiece of his campaign was a centerpiece of his administration. So maybe that pattern will hold.
Yeah, Matt, before we talk about some of the cabinet nominees who are coming up for confirmation hearings this week, what about you? How do you feel about Trump? What do you look forward to the most and worry about the most?
His views, his picks, his plans, his tweets, his activities on trade are what I am currently worried about the most, because I think if the world or the sort of democratic West, as we look at it, goes away from, backs out of its, you know, not just 2.5 decades, but 6 decade, almost 7, a trend towards increasing reductions of tariffs, and it goes more towards a mercantilist system, and the guy that he just appointed to be his head trade representative really has a bad, like, not even Econ 101 campus idea of economics, where like trade deficits are the worst thing ever, and that we're gonna make America great again by going after China's currency and all this kind of stuff. Trump totally ran on that, totally believes in it in all of his public statements. It's through line back to the 1980s, and the people that he is appointing do embrace that. And that's a huge shift, and that could lead to all kinds of unexpected places in concert, acting as it will with similar successes of similar types of politicians and parties throughout the West, France, England, and elsewhere. So that is what I'm worried about the most, although also the follow-on effects of the way that he won, the politics that he won on, even if he doesn't do the worst of what he had said about, say, immigration or, you know, stopping all Muslims from coming into the country. Right. The fact that he was able to win successfully on those politics will itself have bad impact both on politics and policy in a way that we have to watch out for. On the positive side, since you asked about that too, he's nominated a half a dozen people who will be direct threats to the regulatory agencies that they're taking over in a way that George W. Bush almost didn't even come close to thinking about, with a handful of a couple of appointees like Michael Powell at the FCC and Bradley Smith at the FEC, Federal Elections Commission. For the most part, Bush had enablers at the regulatory agencies. Donald Trump has people who are throwing bricks through windows and people who have done interesting things from a libertarian point of view in terms of challenging the orthodoxies of those places and the reach. So if he wants to be a deregulatory president while also being an authoritarian boor, well, that's better than just being an authoritarian boor.
Yeah. I'll also point listeners to the excellent cover story, or one of the stories in the cover package of the latest issue of Reason, Goodbye Obama, where Gene Healy points to the, you know, this is one of the real threats, is the rise or the continued rise of the Caesarian, well, that's not even right, is it? But imperial presidency. Obama pulled a lot of power into the executive branch. He was drafting off of what George Bush had done. And actually, this is a decades long, if not a century or more long, progression towards more and more power being held in the White House. One of the good news pieces about that is that there are people in the Republican Congress, and the Republicans hold majorities in both the House and the Congress, who are pushing back on that. Catherine, do you have any reason to believe that the Republican Congress this time around will be, you know, better, a better hedge against federal power than it was when George Bush was president? He had a Republican Congress for, you know, more or less the first term and change of his presidency. And it didn't go well. They increased spending. They increased regulation. They started a bunch of stupid wars. Are you more hopeful this time around?
I'm certainly not hopeful about the spending question, which I think the horse is out of the barn there already. But I do think that if there's one thing you can rely on in Washington, it's for people to protect their turf. And if Congress perceives Trump as a threat to their turf, as a threat to the scope of their power, then that kind of a catfight could be good. And I think it could be better in some ways than a gridlock driven version of it, because there's always this annoying round of two-sided accusations of hypocrisy, right? Oh, let's hold up all the judicial nominations, and then as soon as the partisan control flips, let's, you know, weep and gnash our teeth about the holding up of judicial nominations. And they won't be able to do that in a fully Republican dominated landscape. So I'm a little bit hopeful for that. I do think, though, Gene Healy's piece, the subhead is something like Obama leaves a loaded gun in the Oval Office. And I think that's true. I do think Trump can do whatever he wants on so many levels that would not have been uncontroversially true 8 years ago, thanks to Obama's systematic expansion of executive power. And Congress should worry about that. I hope Congress is looking at Trump and saying, we got to figure out how to rein this guy in. It's not going to be true overall. The question is whether the couple of people who are principled and feel strongly about it can have any say, or whether Trump finds a way to shove them out.
Right. And Matt, this is interesting in the sense that the Senate recently voted to consider a bill. And, you know, all of this already, you can see how everything is kind of domino daisy chains of this or that. But Mike Lee, who is the guy who headed up the Article One Project, the senator from Utah, a conservative or constitutional conservative Republican. The Article One Project is the idea that trying to get back to what he says is the original intent of the Constitution, that Congress is the first among co-equal branches of government. It's where laws are made and spending decisions are made. He as well as everybody else, with the exception of Rand Paul, the libertarian Republican from Kentucky, signed off on a Senate resolution that would allow $9 trillion in debt to rack up over the next 10 years. And they say this is just because it's part of the Obamacare repeal act. But, you know, it seems like an early indication that, you know, Ted Cruz, who was in favor of increasing the debt in this bill a couple of months ago, you know, would have been, you know, running to the floor of the Senate with his Dr. Seuss library to go on bitching and moaning about how evil Obama was. So do you think the Republican Congress has learned any lessons from those awful years in the early 21st century, which helped give rise to the Tea Party that people like Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul got elected on?
No, I don't think they've learned much of a lesson at all from that. And we've already seen, I mean, there was either a story or just a tweet by Neil King from The Wall Street Journal the other day of talking about how the senators that he's talked to on the Hill are terrified of even one of Trump's nominees, cabinet appointees being stopped, because which would require some Republican to put their thumb on the scale to make that happen, given their majorities. And they're terrified of that because they don't want to face the wrath of Donald Trump. There is
anyway, right? Like the wrath is coming. They might as well bring it on something. Good.
Yes. And Rand Paul will, but there won't be that many other people doing it. And I found it interesting 5 days ago or so that Mike Lee, for the first time, because he's always been a Trump, kind of cheekily put him on the list of potential Supreme Court nominees.
And was that like was that a threat? I mean, this is one of the things people think Trump isn't strategic.
American
but it's kind of
politics
like,
is so awesome right now that it would be like, by putting him on a list of potential Supreme Court nominees, was he threatening him? Like,
no, but it is like you get removed. You get removed from the Senate. Like he's saying to Ted Cruz, hey, you know, I know what your father did and I'm putting you on the Supreme Court. You know, you're out.
Well, without getting into the motivation of Trump, because it's ultimately unknowable, but what would the effects be? Because he did this, floated this trial balloon 5 months ago or so, or I forget what exactly it was, at a time when Mike Lee was about the strongest face of opposition to Trump within the Republican ranks. And at the time, Mike Lee said, no way. 5 days ago, Mike Lee said, yeah, I would consider doing that. And think about that from Trump's point of view, because it's a lot easier to confirm a senator to anything that requires Senate approval than it is just about anybody else. The Supreme Court pick is likely going to be the place where Democrats like try to locate all of their spine and backbone. Chuck Schumer's already indicated that they're going to try to just do a blanket refusal. And you'd be removing one of the potential obstacles to Donald Trump in the United States Senate, knowing that there's no way a Democrat is going to replace Mike Lee. Pretty brilliant if all those things line up there. I don't have a lot of faith in Republicans. The fact that they almost immediately upon retaking the Senate in 2014 just removed the debt ceiling limit. Remember that thing that we were arguing about for 3 years? Yeah. Like every single day, screw it. That's gone. And then blew through the sequestration cap. So that was like a precursor before they got the president. So there's nothing to keep them from doing this. And about the from just like loading on debt, loading on all kinds of bad ideas, going against everything they've ever said about ethics and corruption, given that Donald Trump has a lot of conflicts of interest. And the best news about all that is that, you know, American politics works as a pendulum, and they will, the more that they go all in for whatever Trump does, the more that they will wear whatever failures come out as a result, and also whatever successes come out as a result too. But always bet on failure in American politics.
Well, I'm hoping two things. One is that he nominates Hillary to the Supreme Court, because that would kill her retirement, right? No more hikes in Chappaqua. I was going to say Chappaquiddick, but I guess, you know, it's Chappie something for lions of Democratic power. But what about Obama's legacy at this point? You know, he's got his big speech. Catherine, can you talk about, I mean, what is there? And I know we've gone through this exercise of, you know, okay, what are you going to miss? What do you think was his biggest problem? But is there an Obama legacy? And if so, what is it?
There's a couple things. I mean, I guess he's going to tell us what we're supposed to think in his legacy speech from Chicago tomorrow. But, you know, failing that, there's a couple things he did do well. And one of them I write about in the current issue, which is his space policy was really good. And that, you know, it's the kind of thing that seems off topic, I guess, in this era of, you know, repeal and replace Obamacare and so many other kind of high stakes debates, but
unlimited war in the Middle East,
right?
The end of the Antarctic ice shelf, but space.
But space,
the final frontier.
I mean, this is the kind of issue, though, where you know, a couple of good policy decisions can create a sort of very path-dependent outcomes. And what Obama did was open up the private space industry hugely. So I think, like, you know, when the day comes sometime on year six of Donald Trump's reign and we really need to probably move to Mars, we can thank Obama for the fact that that's going to be an option. But
we're going to be traveling on North Korean rockets, right?
That's
because
fine.
He didn't. Yeah.
That's
no,
be, that's
I agree. And I'm joking about the space policy, partly because after watching Man in the High Castle, the Amazon series, which I enjoyed tremendously, I went back and read the Philip K. Dick novel, which I hadn't, I don't know, in like 25 years. And one of the subtexts or one of the background facts of that is that the German Reich, the Greater German Reich, had actually started colonizing the moon and Mars, I think. And
Because, you know, that's Werner von Braun's handy guy to have around.
Yeah, it's starting to look more and more appealing with every passing day. And talk a little bit about, though, his policy was that he left it alone or that he opened it up to more kind of more cooks in the kitchen. Right?
Yeah, he did a couple things. First of all, he looked at George Bush's space policy and said, we've already spent $9 billion. We have nothing to show for it. This is not a viable path back to the moon and Mars. And he just shut it down, essentially, which required pissing off a lot of House Republicans, among other people, and Senate Republicans, because there's space pork. That is a thing that's real. And a lot of these heavy lift rockets that were built into the Bush Constellation plan were boons to the districts where they were built. And Obama shut a lot of that down the best he could. And he allocated really just a very small amount of money to spend on encouraging private contractors to provide services. He did the same thing in education, race to the top, although God knows he could not shut up about it. And it was the only thing he did in education that was even remotely good. Again, a little bit of money out of a big budget, which opened up a little bit of choice, opened up some structural places where choice could grow. Unfortunately, Trump is the wrong Republican to capitalize on that. I don't see him as necessarily growing those things. As far as we can tell so far, he's not met with anyone from NASA and not met with anyone from the private space industry at Trump Tower in these sort of elevator meetings. What's more, during the campaign, his major statement about space policy was to a 10-year-old, and it was literally, space is terrific. It's
that,
huge.
You know, that was more substantive than when I tried to interview him after the Iran, like an anti-Iran deal rally 2 summers ago, I guess it was. And I shouted out to him as he walked by in front of the Capitol. Hey, what do you think about libertarianism or libertarians? And he's like, a lot of good ideas, a lot of good ideas. And then literally he shoved me out of the way. So.
That's how I feel, too, when people ask me that question. So
that's just how I feel whenever Nick asks me a question.
Any questions.
Yeah, that's true. That's why I only make declarations now. No more questions.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, Obama, to me, the most salient fact about Obama's presidency is that he is the only president in recent memory or possibly ever to have been at war every single day that he was in office. And if that's our new normal, that's horrific. And he campaigned on the opposite of that. So are we going to be at war every single day of the Trump administration? And what will Trump's wars look like?
I believe it was John Rambo at the end of First Blood who said, you just don't turn it off. Nothing is over. Matt, what about you? What Obama legacy stories that you care to share?
I think the best things that he did are things that he didn't do. He didn't, after Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana, although they waited around for 9 months thinking about it, about what they should do, what the federal government should do in this in the case of flagrant disregard of federal drug laws, they ultimately decided not to fight the losing battle of trying to have their limited supply of cops go after these people. And this was after a first term in which he raided more medical marijuana dispensaries than George W. Bush had in 2 terms. That allowed for this thing that is happening that is wonderful, which is that we are irreversibly, I think, ending the war on marijuana at the very least, which is the major by a disproportionate share amount of the war on drugs itself. Once the war on marijuana is completely kind of repealed for the most part, then I think you'll start to see action on other drugs as people apply the lesson. But it's an odd thing. I mean, I wrote a column 3 years ago or so making the tallest midget argument that it could be in 10 years time that we look back and declare that Barack Obama was the most libertarian president since the end of the Cold War. And you go, my God, that can't possibly be true. Well, it doesn't mean he's libertarian at all, but it means that a couple of libertarian things happened on his watch and he didn't obstruct them. So gay marriage became a thing. Remember that, you know, he had Joe Biden, of all people, float a trial balloon saying, eh, maybe that's normal. Let's allow that to happen. So, okay, great. He stood out of the way as society rushed over and undid this stupid thing that Bill Clinton had introduced, the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996. Well, that's a good thing.
And which Hillary Clinton supported, or she was anti-gay marriage up through, what, like 2013 or so?
Yeah. So it's a weird thing. Because we have this, as Gene Healy has pointed out, we over-focus on what the president is and what power he has, and we imagine powers that he doesn't have and attribute it all to them. Because of all this, Obama will be given credit that he doesn't actually really deserve on both the drug war and gay marriage, because he didn't really lift a finger in a brave sense. I find him to be a crushing disappointment on criminal justice reform, which is exactly what he's trying to do one of his victory laps about, as evidenced by his Harvard Law Review article that Anthony Fisher wrote about on our website. A lot of key elements of criminal justice reform, possible measures, have been out there ready to go for 5-10 years. And he hasn't really done much except sort of talk a lot about guns and then wring his hands pretty anxiously about disproportionate racial effects here and there. But there's things that he could have done and did not do. The other thing that he didn't do, which is good, even though we've been at war every single day of his presidency, is that he didn't launch a major new ground troop war. And that's, I mean, talk
oh
about
Oh, my God, our standards are so low.
Exactly.
Yeah, let's talk about defining presidency down.
That will be a thing. I think the only way to argue that he's got this great legacy, and Jonathan Chait has a book that I'll be debating it with Soho Forum on Jan 17th, I believe, called Audacity, that's all about this. But I think the only argument you made is Obamacare is great, and that he staved off the financial crisis, wrecking the entire international financial system. So the second one of those is complete unknowable. Could be true. Could not be true. I happen to think it's not true, but it's an unknowable. It's an you can't falsify it or verify it one way or the other. And the other one, I think Obamacare legacy will quickly become unlegacied here, whatever Republicans do to end it and further screw it up in the next few months. So I can't see you walking away thinking he's a great president.
This is a great piece in the next issue, is Peter Suderman's piece about Obamacare, where he charts very convincingly the fact that only Obama is left kind of defending Obamacare as a complete act of reform unto itself. Right. And pretty much all other congressional Democrats and even Hillary Clinton to some extent are now saying, well, it was a good start. And meanwhile, Republicans, who suddenly have to actually make decisions and look at this stuff in a kind of practical way, are saying, oh, yeah, repeal, repeal, repeal. But what they really mean is do something in name only, leave the popular stuff in place, probably hasten the death spiral. So this sort of interesting reversal where his signature legislative achievement, which is such a cliche, like George Orwell wants to just shoot us all in the face for saying that phrase over and over. But it's already been abandoned. And whatever form of it is left is going to be a very kind of technocratic, bureaucratic slate of reforms, not a dramatic change in the end, I think.
I agree with you. And, you know, the one thing I do hope the Republicans change is that instead of letting kids stay on their parents' plan until they're 26, I think that kids until they're 26 should have to pay for their parents' health care just to give a little bit of payback. And I say that as my kids are getting older and I am getting poorer. But more, more to the point, and I think this is in a lot of the coverage that Reason has done recently, is that so much of Obama's work was done through executive orders and executive actions and regulatory agencies that he lays open. And this is part of what I think Healy had talked about in his Reason piece. And I know Peter talks about this in his forthcoming piece and in other conversations I believe Damon Root at Reason has also talked about it. If you have a pen and a phone in order to kind of get your way, it means that once you're out of office, a lot of that can change very quickly. And you can see that with things like certain types of criminal justice reform, as Matt, you were talking about, where because he didn't act on it legislatively, it's, you know, Trump is not, you know, he's a law and order candidate. He's interested in kind of seeing incarceration rates go up if he thinks that will help bring crime rates down, et cetera. And it's an interesting question for how much of Obama's legacy we'll be talking about. He leaves office much more popular than George W. Bush did. The economy is in a slow growth mode, which some people see as a success. Other people say, you know what, this is the biggest absence of growth that we've had in the American experiment going back to, you know, when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth. So it remains to be seen what we'll be talking about. Although for me, and I'd be interested in your guys' take on this, going back to Trump and Obama, you know, Trump, it seems to me that a lot of liberals in particular are terrified that Trump is the start of something new. I see him really as the last gasp of a kind of baby boomer governance model, which includes Obama. It included Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and certainly George W. Bush, where it's just you kind of just spend more. You know, your rhetoric is completely unmatched by your deeds. So Obama is talking about, you know, he was against the drug war as a candidate, and then suddenly he was arresting more people. George W. Bush was going to have a humble foreign policy, did the exact opposite. The Republicans are in favor of, you know, limited government, and they just blow the doors off it. The Democrats, it's not even clear what they believe because they've done so poorly. They've lost any kind of institutional power, not just in the White House, but through the state governments. I mean, are we circling around a drain of an American era? And Matt, you had written about how clearly we seem to be in the death throes of a neoliberal era. But, you know, is Trump the start of something new, or is he the last gasp? And if so, you know, what kind of my pillow do we put on him to make sure that he does not get up out of bed, figuratively, I guess?
I think even though he is aping a lot of not just the policy, but the language of a lot of existing politicians, I spent the end of last week, and hopefully we'll soon be able to watch the fruits of my labors, finding almost word for word statements that Trump has made both recently and on the campaign trail with every single prominent Democratic politician you can possibly name. You know, we need to punish companies that are thinking about moving abroad. We need to crack down on China's currency. We need to do X, Y, and Z. They're all like popular Democratic positions thrown out there. So, yes, he has lifted from that playbook, and he's built on from an existing politics on the right when it comes to immigration, a bunch of other stuff. Given all that, yes, that is true. However, I think he is something new, or he's the harbinger of something that is new that's been percolating for a while that goes back to this kind of nationalism politics in America, which we usually find a way to rub the harsh edges off of. He has kind of introduced that new, and he's changing public opinion, or helping to change public opinion, particularly among conservatives on issues like just trade and economics, some pretty mm-hmm. basic stuff. So
this is the populism that, you know, that gets wedded to a Republican politics of xenophobia and tradeophobia, if that's a term.
Yeah, I mean it's the anti Davos mm-hmm. of politics. And some of that will be kind of a healthy corrective of, you know, Davos man went too far absolutely for sure, and was an arrogant prick in the process, which is also true. But then what is it replaced with? Are we going to see 5%, 15%, 35% tariffs all over the place? That's a new weird thing that doesn't feel like what we've seen in the last 40 years.
My initial impulse was to say that the new thing that Trump was doing was this particular type of corporate bullying, which is not crony capitalism as we've known it in the past, but something a little different. We actually have a piece in the next issue, though, of Reason, which is by David Henderson, who's a sort of very interesting historian and economist. And he argues that it's of a piece with things that have come before, including the way that Obama handled the GM bankruptcy and subsequent mm-hmm. bailout, which I actually ended up finding pretty convincing. So I would say, you know, even the stuff where Trump looks like he's doing something new, you know, using Twitter to change the internal bureaucratic decisions of American corporations about where they locate their factories, for instance, is actually even that is something that was already normalized by Obama and, as Henderson argues, by JFK before him and by mm-hmm. other presidents before them. So
some of those actions, there's legislation introduced by Democrats as recently as 2010 to, you know, enshrine all of these Trump policies into law. And it was only a minority of Republicans who blocked this from happening. So if they revoted that right now, it would probably pass with Republican support over Democratic opposition in terms of punishing companies that site their factories abroad and imposing tariffs or taxes on them and this kind of stuff and punishing them individually. So, yeah, that's that is part of where we've been going. And a lot of what happened also in the Obama administration is a lot of kind of a shaming exercises, the attempts to shame GE over climate, that's hauling people up and in front of Congress to have them answer for the way that, you know, ExxonMobil,
Apple tax dodge accusations, right, which were, you know, they had no legal grounding in particular.
Right. Although they were true that, I mean, you know,
it was true that Apple was minimizing its tax bill, but it wasn't true that they were doing anything illegal.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And you know, that's one of the things where Trump is actually might, you know, half a loaf might be decent, where he's even Democrats have understood that the corporate tax rate has to change and that it's ultimately paid by customers anyway. But we might see this, you know, is where some of his deregulatory moves might actually end up benefiting regular Americans, as opposed to, you know, the idea of slapping massive taxes on Toyota Corollas that are built in Mexico because, you know, obviously only people with millionaire bank accounts buy Corollas. So making them more expensive in America is really going to screw the poor. But well, let's leave it here. Thank you both, Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine.
Thank you.
And Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Thanks for talking.
Danke.
And this has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. We are online at iTunes. Please subscribe to the Reason Podcast at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. And keep checking in at Reason.com. We update the site multiple times a day and subscribe to Reason Magazine. It's just $15, and you can find out how to do that for a digital edition or a print edition at Reason.com. Thanks for listening.